Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. Here's some career advice for you. I'm not going to charge. You're going to have dumb ideas no matter what you do. And when you do, you're probably going to hear a voice telling you that the idea is so dumb you should definitely not do it. So anyway, here's my two cents. If you love your dumb idea enough, ignore that voice. Do the stupid idea. Guy Branum, the comedian and host of the podcast Pop Rocket, has his own TV show. It's called Talk Show the Game Show. And when the show first started, he went through that exact same kind of doubt. He had a great guest lined up, Moby, the electronic musician. He wanted to take Moby hunting. And since Moby is an outspoken vegan, why not make him hunt tofu?
My executive producer was essentially like, Guy, I don't know about this. Maybe we should just do some music trivia thing with him. We're putting an entire segment on Moby's comedy skills. Do you really think we should? And I was like, We put so much effort into it. We hung seitan and tempeh in bushes. And I was so uncertain about how the entire show was going to go. And the moment I handed that Nerf gun to Moby, and then a 51-year-old man bounced around like a child, shooting tofu skins out of the sky, it was magnificent. And from that moment on, I knew that things would be good.
I think we've all had that moment, handing a Nerf gun to Moby. It's Bullseye. Coming up, I'll talk with Guy about his talk show, about the importance of being charming on television, and the challenge of getting his guests off script. Guy is also a stand-up comic. He talks a lot about being gay in his act. He says growing up gay in a small rural town in Northern California was hard, like you'd expect, but in a weird way, it kind of makes him feel like he belongs.
We all come from somewhere, and so we do have this shared thing of we all left behind different worlds that didn't understand us. And in that case, it is the cool guy with cool parents from Manhattan who explained to him that he was gay when he was 12 years old, who is the outsider and doesn't have that thing.
Then we'll talk about the great Donny Hathaway and how the singer's live album is one of the greatest records ever recorded. Finally, we all know how sports can make people do totally insane stuff. I'll make the case that there's no better person to document that craziness than Errol Morris. That's all coming up on Bullseye. Let's go. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. This week, we're listening to my interview with Guy Branum from last year. Guy is a comic I've known for quite a long time. Behind the microphone, he is brutally honest, exceptionally quick-witted, and absolutely one of the funniest people I've ever met. So over at my company, Maximum Fun, it made total sense to give him his own podcast. He hosts Bullseye's sister show, which is called Pop Rocket. It's a weekly panel discussion on pop culture, one of my favorite shows that we produce here. Recently, Guy wrote a book. It's called My Life as a Goddess, a memoir through unpopular culture. It's a collection of essays from Guy, kind of a combination memoir and manifesto, stories from his childhood, college, his early days as a comic, and also, you know, his opinion on football movies and politics and which city has the hottest guys. It is Los Angeles, by the way. And did you know that he has his own TV show, too? Oh, it is so funny. It is called Talk Show the Game Show. It's recently finished its second season on True TV. And like you might have gathered from the name, it is a perfected version of talk shows and game shows. Guy cuts out all the stilted, forced charm of talk shows and swaps out regular old game show contestants for real-deal celebrities. Moby, Wanda Sykes, Colin Quinn, Tiffany Haddish, just to name a few. He literally makes going on a talk show into a game show with a complicated scoring system and the whole nine yards. And if you're wondering how it all plays out, here's a little bit from the very beginning of a classic episode.
Tonight, these three all-stars will square off for the title of Best Talk Show Guest in America. And it all starts with this five-point kickoff question. John Sally was in Bad Boys. Tiffany Haddish was in Girl Trip. And Dan Pukatinski was on Grey's Anatomy. For 5 points, which hormone produces male secondary sexual characteristics? Tiffany Haddish.
Prostate.
Sorry, no, that's incorrect.
Testosterone.
Testosterone is correct. Congratulations, Dan Bukatinski. You've just taken the lead, but it's still anybody's game because it's time to play Talk Show, the game show.
Guy Branum, welcome to Bullseye.
Good to be here.
Guy, you grew up in Sacramento, California, but not in Sacramento, California. And any Californian knows that immediately outside of Sacramento, California, is a vast sea of those billboards for Clover Stornetta Dairy and basically like pastures.
Right. When people think of California, they think of celebrities and waves and good times and maybe lesbians and winery in the north. But in the middle of California, there is a vast sea of like yellow dead grass where all of your boutique agricultural products come from. So I'm from Sutter County, California, the prune basket of the world.
Is that the real name of Sutter County, California?
Well, they don't actually call it that, but we are very much a prunes, peaches, walnuts, and almonds kind of town, and we have the largest prune dryer in the world.
Now, Guy, you're gay.
I am gay.
Gay, you're Guy. Did you know other gays as a kid?
Well, it's very interesting because I did actually, as a small child, I was exposed to two gay couples. We never called them that. My parents only referred to them by the most common slur for gay people. But there were a pair of doctors who lived on the other side of the orchard from us. And there were two men who owned a flower shop that my mom worked for. So it was something that I was aware of, but in a space that was hostile enough to that it, one of the first things I knew about it was that it was a horrible, horrible, horrible life. And then my music teacher, she just had a roommate that she spent a lot of time with. We didn't have a name for that.
How old were you when the music teacher had a roommate?
I was like 6 or 7 when I learned about all of these things. I distinctly remember my mom told me about her bosses in kind of the nicest way I ever heard gay people described before I went to college, where she was scared that I would say something embarrassing in front of them. So she said, like, they are married like a man would be to a woman. They are a couple. And I remember being a little bit confused by that, but then sort of learning all of the terrible things that go along with that. And never really, at that point in time, I didn't associate the trouble I was having with culture and people around me with that in any way. I just knew that I was being a boy wrong, and it took me a while to be able to put those things in the same part of my head.
What was wrong about the way you were being a boy?
Look, I did a lot of trying to hold other boys' hands in kindergarten. I had tried to hold everybody's hands in kindergarten. I never wanted to fight with people. They were very upset by the fact that I didn't want to fight with people. I didn't do any torturing of cats, and that's just a normal part of a boy's development in a farm town. I wanted to play with Barbie dolls. I played with He-Man, but I also wanted, I adored Barbie dolls and enjoyed, I wanted to learn to French braid. I wanted to learn to French braid so hard, and they were just like, no, you're not allowed to do that. You shouldn't want that. You should want to be inside or outside. But I desperately wanted to be inside, learning how to cook and French braid.
Oh, a boy's dream of plating.
It just seemed like the most sophisticated thing a person could do.
I want to play a clip from your most recent stand-up album, which is called Effable. And in this clip, you're talking about the fact that being gay is no longer the very special and exclusive fraternity that it once was.
It's a little bit sad the way things have changed because, like, it used to be that to be an out gay person, you had to be amazing. You had to be like Oscar Wilde or Virginia Woolf. Now, essentially, we'll let anyone in. Being gay used to be Harvard. Now it's Chico State.
When did you start to think about yourself as gay?
Really late. Like, I wasn't, if you'd asked me if I was gay in college, I would have laughed and explained it away. I didn't come out until law school.
I want to be clear, like, when you laughed and explained it away when you were in college, was that because
you were trying to hide something you knew to be true, or because you were still trying to figure out what you were trying to hide?
It is, like, I was very specifically using the Freudian defense mechanism of denial. Like, not repression. I knew that the thing that aroused me sexually was men. But I was trying to find any way to have an excuse to say I wasn't gay. Because that was a bad thing and a weird thing, and I didn't want to be associated with that. There was just something broken in me that meant I was turned on by men, and somehow I was going to be able to fix it. And it took a lot of Berkeley to be able to make me be, like, okay with that and understand those things in the same place.
Did you understand that you wanted to live in a different world?
Yeah, that I was able to accept from a very early age. And within came a lot of hostility from my town and to some extent my family of why was I so committed to not wanting to be part of this thing that had no interest in me being there, like a world that kind of hated me and was constantly policing me for my behavior. There was always a lot of, what, you think you're better? And thinking I was better was the only plausible escape from just the hell of everyone constantly being mad at me for the things that seemed most instinctual to me.
It seems like that must have been a really intense conflict, not only because people were always giving you that, I don't know what you want to call it, that guilt trip, that line of attack, but also because no matter how painful it is your home. And so, like, for you, you have to deal with the idea that you want to leave this home that is your home.
It's strange because the things that I have most connection to and most ownership of are very complex emotionally for me. Like, there's the very weird thing of, Jesse, you may not imagine this about me, but I miss pheasant hunting a great deal. Like, every morning during the fall, when I was like 14 until I left for college, my dad would wake me up at 5:30 in the morning and we would go out to some rice field somewhere and we would trot around and we would hunt pheasants. And I hated it more than life itself. It was torture. There was nothing about it that was fun. And now I'm so nostalgic for that experience of like watching a retriever do its job and smelling a pheasant as you cut it open to remove its entrails. Like, and the thing is they're not really things I can do anymore. It's not like I have a dog. It's not like my parents have a dog that you could do this with. And it's so distanced from my own life. But the only reason I'm able to have that kind of nostalgia with it is because I am so distanced from it.
You played on the football team.
I played on the football team. My football coach was one of the few adult men who wasn't terrible to me while I was growing up. There was something like his masculinity was like validated enough by being the football coach that he thought I was great. And like all of these other guys were like constantly like just so pissed off at me. Like to understand my town is like it's a very dust bowly town where all of the old white guys have southern accents because they were all born in Oklahoma or Arkansas. And like the whole time I was growing up, they would always be, what do you want to do when you grow up? And my usual answer was either waitress or writer. And then they would always be like, don't you want to be a football player? And were so mad at me for not wanting to be a football player.
They didn't even suggest that you become a waiter instead of a waitress.
I was very young then. And it seemed kind of adorable when I was three. There was something so weird and cool about the footballiest of the guys being like, oh, yeah, he's great.
Were there good things about being on the football team?
Well, I'm not supposed to talk about it, but like the most wonderful and most terrifying thing for a 14-year-old gay boy is walking into a locker room because it is both the simultaneous moment of like, oh, God, everything I ever wanted to see is right here before me. And also, I am so in danger of being found out right now. Like, you do kind of feel like a spy, like you're like Carrie Russell in The Americans, like undercover and people are about to find you out. But that part of it was cool.
At what point did you start to think of yourself as gay?
It took the internet. One of the reasons I do love that joke you played about Harvard or Chico State is that I benefited from the 90s. Like, I have to coldly realize that I didn't just pop out of the closet when I was 16 in 1992. It took the world changing for me to be safe enough to be one of those people. And so I have so much regard and admiration for the people who were coming out in 1932 or 1962. What would I have done without them? But it really took, in the same way that, like, the printing press broke politics and the Catholic Church, and we still haven't gotten things back together again, the internet changed identity and sexuality. Like, you can't keep a secret from yourself the way that you could before, when it is just so easy to privately learn about it and communicate with other gay people. And it took me being terrified, but chatting with other gay guys online and realizing, oh, they're people. They're very nice. They're wonderful. They're more like me than the people I was taught to trust. And that allowed me to start my head changing. And things like The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, and, you know, this, all of this wonderful, fabulous culture that came at us in the 90s, Clueless, that allowed me to understand that I wasn't a horrible thing. I was actually a rather wonderful thing.
How old were you?
I was 23 when I came out, but it was, I essentially became happy for the first time really in my life in college, like around 21. And it took 2 years of feeling fine and satisfied and no longer scared that somebody was going to make me work in a ditch for the rest of my life before I could sort of raise that topic and tell my parents.
What was it like for your parents and for the world back home?
Well, I came out of the closet when I was in law school in Minnesota over the phone to my parents. And it was very distanced, but I chose that because I knew that it wasn't going to go well. They were mad at me. Like, they were very deeply mad at me. They sort of, like, shut down to me for, like, a couple of years. They were going through some hard stuff themselves. But it was also, for a lot of gay kids, I think you're so aware of the problem that you're potentially going to be. And people are so likely to tell you what a problem you are that you're just trying to not be a problem as much as possible. And it was really the first time in my life that I said in sort of a deep way, I need something out of you right now. And neither of my parents were really there for me. And my mom had always been great. My mom was the conduit where, like, all of this culture and wonderfulness, and my mom is Jewish, my dad is not. But my mom was also a connection to the idea of we live in a larger world than just Sutter, California. And she wasn't really able to be there for me at that point in time. And it was hard, you know, it was hard, but it did force me to reach out in new directions for support. And I learned a lot about the world and myself.
Do you see your parents' reaction differently now than you did then?
It's nice to have a story where they figured it out and things got great. My dad died about a year ago, and there never came a point in time when he would directly address me being gay. He didn't need to hear about it. And if I tried to talk about it at all, and particularly when I would go home, one of the things I deeply needed to do was to build some sort of bridge between the person I was between 0 and 17 and the person I am now. And my parents were deeply uncooperative with that. One of the things about this question of, like, can you have any relationship to the place that you're from? Jesse, it's so beautiful. There's this tiny little, like, range of volcanoes there, and it, like, right in the middle of the Central Valley, and it is so beautiful, and I love it so much. But any time I tried to talk about the person I was when I lived there or what it was like being there, they would get so mad. And that's hard, because part of being a whole human being is not pretending that my life is West Hollywood and graduate degrees, but understanding that a lot of it is finishing concrete and smelling the guts of a pheasant. My mom's...
Why were they getting mad? What were they getting mad about?
They don't want to hear a story about how they were someone's jailer for 17 years, especially not when they were working very, very hard to keep my teeth taken care of and buy me G.I. Joes and, you know, pay for me to go to Future Business Leaders of America conventions. Like, they thought they were doing their best job. And then I come back with this narrative of I was in pain the whole time. And, you know, these are people who, they had my sister when they were 18 and 19. They had me when they were 24. They worked their entire lives just to, like, give us a better life. And they did. And now I have to lay some narrative of oppression on top of that. Who do I think I am? My mom is better because women have to understand other people. And for a long time, it was really hard for her to talk about that stuff. So my parents also didn't have any interest in paying attention to any creative work that I did because they were scared that I would speak ill of them or talk about being gay openly. And I do one of those things a lot in my act. So they never really paid attention to what I did. And then one day I was coming home from recording Pop Rocket here. And my dad said, "What did you do today?" And I told him I recorded my podcast. And he said, "Now what's that again?" And this was like the 17th time I had explained to the podcast to him. And I just sort of said, "If you cared, you would know by now." And like 3 weeks before he died, he listened to a Pop Rocket. And it was a Pop Rocket we had done about pop culture of the 60s. So he was able to like relate to it and understand it. And my father was not, he did not make gestures to understand me better. And that he tried, like, and kind of was able to enjoy something. So before I lost him, was a really wonderful thing. And it would not have happened without you. So I very much appreciate that.
I'll continue my conversation with Guy Branum after a break. He'll tell me about what he sees as one of the most important things on his television show, charm. It's not as easy as it sounds. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for this podcast and the following message come from ZipRecruiter. Hiring is challenging, but ZipRecruiter can make it simple, smart, and fast. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 job boards with one click. Then, it scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply for your job. Try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/bullseye. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. The Emmy Awards are coming up, so this week we're listening back to interviews with some nominees and people whose shows are nominated, like Issa Rae, Jake Tapper, Brian Tyree Henry, Tim Gunn, and Stephen Colbert. So check out this week's Emmy series on Fresh Air.
Ooh, girl, I'm lost. It's a scary time out here for intersexual minorities.
Don't worry, I know a place where we can learn, laugh, and play.
Where?
Minority Corner with the Wonder Twins of Podcasting, Aneke and James.
Wow, they sound fabulous, smart, and incredibly attractive.
At Minority Corner, you'll get everything from the history you were never taught.
Like the history of Chinese immigration, or who was James Baldwin, or African queens of old, like Queen Candace.
Plus, awesome book recommendations outside of the usual white male cisgender canon. Interviews from comedians, artists, writers, and activists.
Well, that sounds like a party. But hold up. What about movie and TV reviews starring folks whose melanin is popping?
Well, you know Minority Corner loves their deep dive into pop culture, all from a perspective that's Black, queer, and ladylike.
Ooh, yes. And with the election just around the corner, sounds like Aneke and James are gonna get us information.
Not to mention self-care tips, how to be an ally, and how you can get involved in your community so you can help fix this mess.
You know what? James and Aneke kind of sound like us.
That's because...
They are Minority Corner.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest this week is Guy Branum. He and I talked last year. Guy hosts the wonderful show Pop Rocket here at Maximum Fun. He's also the host of True TV's talk show The Game Show, and he's the author of a brand new book, My Life as a Goddess, a memoir through unpopular culture.
I want to ask you a question that has to do with a theory that I've just formulated. So tell me if I'm off the deep end, but I know that through college and law school, you participated on these brain competition teams of, I think, a couple different kinds, right? Like college quiz bowl.
Quiz bowl, yeah.
You were on the quiz bowl team.
At Berkeley and at the University of Minnesota.
And I feel like Quiz Bowl is a thing where not only do you get rewarded for being smart, but there's rules and standards that make it so that the playing field is even.
Yeah. I mean, the extent to which social rules make me happy because I understand, like, explicit social rules make clear what should be going on. When I was in high school, I was obsessed with parliamentary procedure, which is another kind of just sort of, like, providing clear structures for behavior. And if you're working within that, you're fine. And, yeah, like, as somebody who felt uncertain for most of my life, the clear validation of you ring a bell and you say Antigone and they say 10 points, just glorious. So, so satisfying.
Pro tip, the answer is always Antigone. take it from a Quiz Bowl champion and a many-time academic decathlon medalist. Jesse and Guy say Antigone. That actually is pretty much the premise of Talk Show the Game Show. It is, what if being charming had rules?
Yes, exactly. So one day I was on my way to a Quiz Bowl tournament in Michigan, I believe, and I was in the back of a 15-passenger van on like a 12-hour drive, and my friend Anne-Marie and I were talking about television because that's what we talked about, and I just came down with a hard stance of there's a right and wrong way to be on a talk show. And from then on, we started discussing this idea of Talk Show the Game Show. And then 10 years later, I had left Chelsea Lately and was in like a career funk and didn't know what was next. And one night I just stayed up late and I was like, well, how would Talk Show the Game Show work? And then I stayed up into the middle of the night writing up these rules. And then I asked Jamie Flam at the Improv if I could come and do it. And he said yes. And it was just so weird to, over 10 years later, this like whim I turned into reality. Like dingy, like experimental space next to the real comedy club kind of reality. But it was still real enough for me. And it was the night after the first Talk Show the Game Show is one of the happiest experiences I've ever had in my life. I could not go to sleep. I was just so delighted that it had worked.
Anyone who's ever heard you talk, Guy, and certainly anyone who's ever listened to you guest hosting this show or hosting Pop Rocket, knows that charming is your favorite word in the English language. It's rare for you to complete a paragraph without using the word charming. It's your highest compliment. And I wonder why you came to value that word and idea so much.
It's nice when people are nice, you know? Like, it's nice when people are nice and people are giving the fullness of themselves to that. Like, so frequently when people come to Talk Show the Game Show, they think that they're supposed to be pretending to be doing something, that they're supposed to be doing some sort of parody of a person on a talk show. And the thing is talk shows at their best are people having a real conversation with the utmost of themselves. And I love Babette's Feast. It is a Danish movie from the late 80s about essentially about a woman who cooks a meal for some people. There's not much more to it. But one of the things she says is that an artist's dream is to give their let me give my utmost. And I love to give my utmost, and I love to have my friends give their utmost and get to enjoy that. It's a beautiful thing. And when you're raised as a man in our society, giving your utmost is supposed to be this zero-sum game. It's supposed to be that there's a winner and a loser. And charm is the game where everybody wins.
You know, I feel like the record should reflect that with all of the weighty emotional topics that we've discussed on this program, which there have been many, the moment that you were forced to wipe a tear away was when we started talking about charm.
I cry at good things. Like, I cry a lot, but I cry at things that make me happy. Because here's another of my grand theories. Why do they call us gay? Why is the euphemism for homosexual people that we are happy, especially when we know that gay people are so much more likely to experience depression and experience suicide or suicide attempts. And the thing is like, at the end of the day, once you realize I'm probably never going to have children, I'm probably who are a biological union of me and the person I love. Once you realize there's not really a religion that wants me, you have to have some reason to keep going. And a lot of people don't keep going, but the people who do figure out why. And I think that's why we as a people end up doing things that are fun and beautiful and charming, is because we have to, in an immediate sense, know why we're living this life and why there's a reason to keep going. So hard things happen, and I will get through them, but it is the wonderful things. It is Beyonce in the Dreamgirls medley at the Academy Awards the year that Dreamgirls was nominated that makes me cry every time, because that's worth living for.
One of the reasons that I was so thrilled when you agreed to host the sister show of this show, Guy, was because you really care about people in the world. And I loved the pieces that you made for Totally Biased, the late night talk show that ran for a year or two on FX and FXX a few years ago. You were a writer on the show, and some of the writers came in front of the camera and delivered kind of signature bits. Yours was called No More Mr. Nice Gay. And I want to play one. And you are basically reacting to this guy called Chris Culliver, who played for the 49ers, I think, at the time, who had said some really lousy homophobic stuff, and said it publicly, too. So this is my guest, Guy Branum, on Totally Biased just a few years ago.
To call you out, Chris Culliver, not for being a homophobe, but for being bad at football. You said you can't be with none of that sweet stuff. You want to know what else would have been sweet, Chris? That Super Bowl ring you're never going to have. And hey, Chris Culliver, maybe you should worry less about who gets behind me on Saturday night and worry a little more about Jacoby Jones getting behind you on Sunday night, then passing a pass, then scoring a touchdown. Because people only care what you think because you're good at football. And last Sunday, you weren't that good at football. Ha, ha, you lost.
How did your job on that show end up being, and it's one that you're really good at, calling out stuff?
Well, one of the great things about Kamau is he was very aware of the fact that, like, as a black man who has had to watch white people talk about race on television for his entire life.
W. Kamau Bell, the host of the show.
Yeah. He understands that sometimes it's really annoying to have other people talking about your experience without having any experience in that world of their own. And so he was always really good about wanting people from the show to talk about their perspectives on things. And the thing is like, when you're a gay person, you've just lived a whole life with lots of people expressing opinions about you, and there is a presumption that you will simply be quiet and take it. And one of the things for me was the minute I came out of the closet, I was so full of Berkeley that I was just like, oh no, I will not take it. I will always say what I can. And another thing is years of starting out in stand-up, where people on stage were saying horrible things about gay people, and if I wasn't on the show or I wasn't after them on the show, I didn't get to say anything in response, just filled me with this deep need to be able to get my chance to say, hey, hey, nobody, step the back. And I remember hearing about that stuff from the two 49ers players and getting so mad and so hurt, particularly because they were from San Francisco, the place where I started comedy, and what should be the safest place for gay people in America.
And that was probably that's the football team of the place you grew up.
No, Jesse. We weren't rich enough to like the 49ers.
Was it Raiders country?
Oh, okay. So Raiders was deemed like a little bit edgy and trashy. So we were in this weird in-between territory where, like, my dad thought of us as like better than Raiders fans, but also not fancy enough to be 49ers fans.
Not white wine types like those 49ers
exactly.
fans.
Exactly. So he always liked the Washington Redskins for no reason. But I remember watching the game and seeing the dude get behind him and catch the interception and just being so pleased that I was like, oh, you know, that magical moment when it just crystallizes in your head exactly what you will say to someone. Because, you know, finger up sass is, it's very satisfying in a world where people have constantly been telling you who you are or how you should feel. There's something nice about, even if it doesn't change the world, just getting to let out how you feel.
What are the things in a talk show appearance that you value?
Here's what I want.
Let the record show that Guy struck a delivering the truth pose before saying this.
All right. I want an entrance. I want you to come in and let everybody know you're ready to be on. From one talk show appearance, I want one juicy, beautiful anecdote from your most recent project so that we get a feel of what you're doing, but it humanizes you. And I also just want sort of like a little banter on some sort of area of material, some sort of thing you're interested in so that we get to know what's going on in your life right now. Do you think that juicing has just gone crazy and they're too expensive? I want to hear a little bit of that. And also, I want you to show up looking like you're on a talk show. I want cocktail dresses. I want, you know, a little bit of pop that says you're dressed like you, but you're dressed like the best version of you. And yes, I want you to be drinking or at least make a joke about how the stuff that's in your mug is alcohol, even if it isn't. I want at least pretending.
Guy, we don't have the benefit of a pre-interview on Bullseye, but I do want to ask you, you've been working on Talk Show the Game Show on the True TV network lately.
Yes.
Do you guys get up to a lot of hijinks on set or...
And that's the terrible thing is that I always worry that I don't have enough good anecdotes. I always worry that after I've put all of this stuff together, that I am myself a terrible talk show guest. Our first show, a little rough, didn't go great. Everybody was learning what they were doing. Second show, we had kind of one of the most produced segments we were ever going to do on the show. It was a bonus game for electronic music artist Moby. Are you familiar with Moby?
Sure. The charmer lives in a castle here in Los Angeles.
So my executive producer was essentially like, Guy, I don't know about this. Maybe we should just do some music trivia thing with him. We're putting an entire segment on Moby's comedy skills. Do you really think we should? And I was like... But we put so much effort into it. We hung seitan and tempeh in bushes. Oh, he was hunting tofu. That was the game, is he was hunting tofu. And I was so uncertain about how the entire show was going to go until... Because every time I had done it live, it was a great experience and it always felt fun. But after that first show, I was nervous. And the moment I handed that Nerf gun to Moby, and then a 51-year-old man bounced around like a child, shooting tofu skins out of the sky... it was magnificent. And from that moment on, I knew that things would be good.
We'll finish up my conversation with Guy Branum after a short break. Then, a person with a real-life PhD to tell you why Donny Hathaway Live is one of the greatest albums of all time. It's Bullseye from MaximumFun.org and NPR. Support for this NPR podcast and the following message come from Babbel, a language program that quickly teaches real-life conversations in a new language. Choose from Spanish, French, Italian, German, and more. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons use interactive dialogues and speech recognition technology to get you speaking your new language correctly and confidently. Try Babbel for free by downloading the app or going to Babbel, Babbel.com.
I'm Linda Holmes. There's more stuff to watch these days than you can ever get to. That's why we make Pop Culture Happy Hour. Twice a week, we give you the lowdown on what's worth your time and what's not. Find Pop Culture Happy Hour on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Is there a dog in a car at a bar on the street? Yay!
I'm Allegra Ringo, a small dog owner. My dog Pistachio howls when she's excited.
And I'm Renee Culvert, a big dog owner. My dog Tugboat tips over when he's sleepy.
And we co-host a podcast called Can I Pet Your Dog that airs every Tuesday. We bring you all things dog.
Yes, dog news, dog tech, dogs we met this week. We also have pretty famous guests on Butt Legs. We're not going to let them talk about their projects.
No.
Just want to hear about those dogs.
We don't want to hear about your stuff. Only your dogs. So join us every Tuesday on Max Fun.
It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. If you're just joining us, we're listening to my conversation from last year with Guy Branum. He's the host of the podcast Pop Rocket. He's also host of True TV's talk show The Game Show. Last month, he published his first book. It's called My Life as a Goddess, a memoir through unpopular culture.
I feel like one of the sort of rhetorical modes of funny gay men in America is bitchiness. It's by no means the only one, but it's one that's reasonably prevalent. And I wonder how you feel about that as a way of being funny and a way of being in the world.
A, let us begin by saying I am proud of it. Bitch is a slur that we have for women who have opinions that they are not supposed to have. As somebody who is categorized as unmasculine, I am proud to have opinions, and I am proud to have opinions that are at odds with many of the set opinions of the world. There comes a point where you do have to wonder, how much am I letting my scar tissue define me? How much am I just being a creature of my anger? And it's really interesting when I see, like, when I was first on television on a regular basis on Chelsea Lately, I started to have this experience of, like, gay guys complaining about me and complaining about how I was too fat and I wasn't a real gay guy for that reason, or I was too effeminate and so I was too gay for that reason. And they were telling what their problem was with me in their sassiest possible way. And I had to kind of respect it and love it, because I knew that that's what I would have been doing if I was watching some gay guy on TV and wasn't the gay guy. I would be trying to express control over my world in some way and let out some degree of rage. And I think that a hard thing for the gay community, the gay male community particularly, is that we do so come from a space of criticism that we have a hard time making culture of our own and respecting culture of our own. God knows we can appropriate other people's culture and turn it into something magical. And appropriation is an important part of gay culture. We are not allowed to have our own culture until we are adults, which means as children, we are forced to learn through analogy and appropriation. I will never apologize for that. But I do think part of being a grown-up is like owning your damage and trying to move beyond it and learning not to just be immediately angry or critical. I love doing crowd work and I love sassing and being mean to someone in the audience. But one of the important things I learned as a stand-up is, like, if you can take a heckler and turn them into a good audience member without making them feel bad, without alienating them, making them feel a little bit bad for shouting too much, but also making them feel warm and loved, like, isn't that better? Doesn't that make the whole audience feel better? Or one time I was at a show and I asked for somebody's name, and a low voice gave me a woman's name. And so I immediately assumed that somebody was making a joke or was, like, trying to subvert me from the audience. And there was that gut comic reaction of tear them apart. And then there was that higher brain function of, guy, you saw a trans woman here earlier. It's probably just her. And it was a very funny comic named Olivia Hader. And there's just something nice about being grown up enough to step back and realize there are answers other than rage. Like, there are answers other than bitchiness. There are answers other than tearing things down. Like, take a moment, breathe, and think if there is an honester or good reason for this.
How comfortable do you feel now in your life being a person that recognizes their scar tissue and moves on, or what you just said?
I get kind of scared of being happy or, like, fine. I get scared that I will lose my edge and I will no longer be a magical, dazzling creature. And it's hard as time goes on to accept your specificity. Like, when you're 15, you're like, I could be anything. But as time goes on, you realize, like, I've made choices, you know, and there are really good parts that go along with it, and there are bad parts that go along with it. I've never really been in a stable romantic relationship, and I could just get mad at myself for that. Or I could understand that I lived in a world where that wasn't a possibility until I was an adult. And that has affected me. We can't pretend like it hasn't affected me. And there are magical things about it. And there are lots of other kinds of happiness that I have gotten to experience. I want to keep learning. I want to keep growing. I want to love as many people around me as I can. But also, like, your life happened. You know, your life happened, and all of those specificities go along with it. And you have to play the hand that you were dealt.
Guy Branum, thank you so much for coming on Bullseye. It was great to get to talk to you.
Thank you for having me, Jesse. It's always a pleasure.
Guy Branum from last year, a brilliant, charming person, one of the most brilliant and most charming I've ever had the pleasure of knowing. His new book reflects that. It's called My Life as a Goddess, a memoir through unpopular culture. Go check it out. He also hosts Bullseye's sister show, Pop Rocket, which is a weekly conversation about pop culture and all the things we love to love therein. Give that a try wherever you listen to podcasts. It's Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. It's time now for Cannonball. Yoo-hoo! We take albums that everyone agrees are classics, or albums that everyone should agree are classics, and find out what makes them so great. This week, we're going to talk about Donny Hathaway Live. It was recorded in Hollywood and New York in 1972. It's almost entirely covers, with Hathaway singing and playing piano. Donny Hathaway Live is one of Emily Lordy's all-time favorite records. Emily is a professor at the University of Massachusetts, where she lectures on black literature and music. She loved this album so much, she wrote an entire book about it for the 33 and a Third series. And if you ask her, she is convinced. Donny Hathaway does not get the respect he deserves.
Donny Hathaway was a phenomenally gifted singer, composer, arranger, and band leader who sort of quietly revolutionized the technical and expressive possibilities of soul music. And yet, despite his contributions, he's often excluded from histories of American popular music. This is in part because Hathaway's earnest sincerity and love of real musical beauty don't necessarily fit our archetypes of the stereotypical macho soul man. Let's take a listen to What's Going On, the first track on his live album.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you.
It's an interesting move for Hathaway to begin his set with this song, which was at that time a massive hit for Marvin Gaye, who was the far more famous artist. So Donny Hathaway is opening a set on a coast, the West Coast, where he's never played, in front of a number of people who have never seen him play before, with a song that has been made famous by somebody who's far better known. There are a couple of different ways to interpret that decision. One would be that it's a kind of modest overture, you know, this idea that even if people don't know Donny Hathaway, they'll probably know this song, so it's a kind of way in. But another way to look at it, and the way that I would tend to interpret it, is that it's like the ultimate gangster move. Donny Hathaway is saying he can take any song and remake it and just kill it and move on.
What's going on?
The first song that I heard from this record was his cover of John Lennon's Jealous Guy.
I was dreaming of a past. And my heart was beating fast. I began to lose control.
He recorded Jealous Guy live just 6 weeks after Lennon had released this song on his album Imagine. And what Hathaway does, as he would do for so many recordings, is to remake this song in his own image. John Lennon's version of the song is a kind of demure apology that is issued from a man whose jealousy has gotten the better of him. When Hathaway sings the song, however, he kind of steadily builds the intensity of the lyric, as if telling the story about this night he got jealous just makes him mad all over again.
I was feeling insecure. You might not want me anymore. I was shivering inside.
So in Hathaway's version, what starts as an apology ends up with a demand as he ends up singing towards the end in this ad-lib, I don't want nobody looking at you. So what's so interesting about that to me is that I think that it kind of exposes the central irony of Lennon's version, because what Hathaway does is to show how insufficient, if not actually hypocritical, it is to apologize for being jealous while also complacently admitting that you're just a jealous guy. In Hathaway's version, that admission comes to seem like more of an excuse than an apology. It comes to seem like it's less the answer to this problem than the problem itself. This is You've Got a Friend, a song originally written and recorded by Carole King. This, to me, is the album's most iconic moment, because the album as a whole documents not only Donny Hathaway's incredible abilities as a pianist, composer, arranger, band leader, and of course, an incredible vocalist, but it also documents the love that you can really hear so clearly between Donny Hathaway and his audience. So you can hear that the crowd erupts as he plays the first chords of the song. Many people in the audience would have recognized it from his duet with Roberta Flack. But they also then took the opportunity to play the role of Roberta Flack as Donny Hathaway is singing the song. You know, they let him sing the first verse alone, but as soon as he gets to the chorus, they join in at full voice. The last track on Donny Hathaway Live is Voices Inside, the subtitle of which is Everything is Everything.
Is everything, yo.
And it's a 13 and a half minute instrumental jam. Even though the song is called Voices Inside, the vocals are not the most important part of this song. Really, this is an instrumental song, and it's especially an opportunity for Donny Hathaway to turn the spotlight on the different members of his band, of whom he was extremely proud. So what we hear is Donny Hathaway breaking this version of the song down into four movements, as he says. That's interesting because it recalls the fact that he studied music education, among other things, as an undergraduate at Howard University. And he retained that kind of teacherly role throughout his life. So here he's explaining how the song works, breaking it down into these four movements. Donny Hathaway sequentially introduces the different members of his band who are going to play these solos. Not only does he introduce Mike Howard, for instance, on guitar, but he tells us that he's from Washington, D.C. Not only does he introduce Willie Weeks, who's going to play what will become a legendary bass solo, but he tells us that Willie Weeks is from Salemburg, North Carolina, and he calls him the baddest bass player in the country. This is important is because it really puts into action what Martin Luther King called the concept of a beloved black community. Donny Hathaway is very intent on distributing the voices of the song amongst the different players in his group. It's also important at a moment when black expressive labor is not necessarily being acknowledged. Donny Hathaway is very careful to work against that idea of obscuring or even stealing black music and not crediting its originators by making a point of naming and identifying and even giving us a place of origin of all of the people who are contributing. It's an album that bears his name only, but he wants to make it clear in the way that he's performing the song that it is truly a collective communal enterprise.
Dr. Emily Lordy, on the album she would add to the pop culture canon, 1972's Donny Hathaway Live. Every week we like to leave you with a pop culture tip from me, your host. It's called The Outshot. The filmmaker Errol Morris loves nothing more than documenting a singular vision. War criminal, executioner, or just guy who loves turkey hunting and won't shut up about it. Errol Morris will document them, and he has won Oscars for this. Every subject is absolutely unique, absolutely committed to something that some might think was crazy or dangerous or laughable. Morris's camera looks them in the eyes and lets them speak. Now, I'll be honest, I love when Morris talks to Temple Grandin or Donald Rumsfeld, important people. But I really love his commitment to regular folks with irregular passions. And there's nothing that incites irregular passion in regular folks like sports. That's why I love Morris's series, It's Not Crazy, It's Sports, 6 short films that he made a couple years ago for ESPN. One of them is about a streaker. He runs naked onto sports fields. His name is Mark Roberts. He's sort of a craftsman, an artist with one broad brush. He says that he loves to hear people laugh.
65,000 people in the stadium all rose at once and screaming and cheering. The adrenaline and that feeling of euphoria was absolutely unbelievable. I think everybody in the world should streak at least once. You have to experience it to understand what the actual feeling's like. I'm not very well endowed. I haven't got a lovely body. If I was well endowed, beautiful body, I'd be a poser. And I wouldn't have to run, I'd just stand there. But I've got to run fast because my body's a mess.
One of the stories is about the lengths people will go to acquire sports memorabilia. It asks simple questions like, who would pay $8,000 for Ty Cobb's dentures?
When I bought them, my oldest son, Brian, he said, Ma, everybody's talking about you. People could have, they could have a car for what you paid for those teeth. They think you're crazy. Of all the items in that auction took almost $22 million. But the dentures got more press than any of, I think there was 1,500 items. So that made me happy. Somebody comes over, they know I'm a collector. What'd you buy now? I'd say, hey, look at these teeth. So you know you'd always have a great conversation piece. That's why I went after them. I just got lucky, but I mean, it's changed my life. I was just a nobody.
There's the story of a man whose life was dedicated to being Mr. Met. You know, the guy with the giant baseball head who dances around at Mets games in New York. And to his downfall. Yes, he had a downfall. There's one about an elaborate heist, a guy who risked his life to steal a giant Michael Jordan jersey. And weirdly, maybe the most powerful of all of them is also the most modest. It's called The Subterranean Stadium. It's about a man, a grown man, well into middle age, who runs a tabletop football league. You know tabletop football? That game from the 60s where the little magnetic guys wobble on a shaky metal field?
If you're a football fan and you have somebody sit down with you who knows how to play this game, teaches you how to play it correctly, with the right equipment and rules, you'll become addicted. You'll love it. The game with moving parts like this, where there's actually action figures and you can control the action, you're the coach. It makes it almost like moving chess, only a lot more fun.
Moving chess?
You make the wrong move, you're cooked.
In some ways, this guy is the least ambitious of the subjects. He's not rich. He doesn't have to scam his way onto the field at the Super Bowl or free climb through the ceiling of a basketball arena. He just paints the new logo onto football figurines, brings a few friends into his basement on the weekend, keeps stats. But he is inflamed by a sincere and dedicated passion. His friends go along with it because they love him. They buy into the madness.
What keeps us going year after year after year?
John, nothing makes him happier than to see us down there having a good time, arguing with each other.
You gonna play this forever?
That's one of the beauties of this game, is we can be old and decrepit and still play it.
As long as I can get up and go down them cellar stairs, yeah, I'll be playing till I can't play no more.
And from what you say, you'll be some ethereal spirit above.
Who knows? Who knows what the future holds? But I'll be ready for it.
Because the truth is that sports don't matter. Ask the 25 public radio listeners writing me letters right now. Sports is absurd, like fundamentally absurd. Jerry Seinfeld once said, and I think it's very insightful, that we're basically rooting for laundry. But that passion that sports incites, it does matter, especially when we share it. Acknowledging its absurdity reduces none of its power. Of course, it's ridiculous for this man to spend his nights changing the uniforms on little plastic men with a single hair paintbrush. Of course, his invented pageantry in a basement in the Midwest is absurd. But his hand is guided by sincere feeling and a desire to share it with the world, or at least connect with a few other people. And this is where Errol Morris's great gift shows itself. He points the camera at that feeling, at that passion, and then he listens when it speaks. That's my outshot. That's it for this week's Bullseye. Bullseye is recorded at MaximumFun.org World Headquarters, overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where those scooters that you rent with apps have started to appear. Needless to say, I think there will be an island of them in the middle of MacArthur Park Lake before long. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. He had help from Casey O'Brien. Our production fellows at Max Fun are Jesus Ambrosio and Shayna Deloria. Our senior producer at Max Fun is Laura Swisher. Our interstitial music was provided to us by Dan Wally, a.k.a. DJW. Our theme song was recorded by The Go Team. Our thanks to The Go Team and to their label, Memphis Industries. If you'd like to hear any of our past shows, all of them are free and available to you. You can find them in your favorite podcast app at MaximumFun.org or on YouTube. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. I'm on Twitter, at Jesse Thorne. And I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.